Mr. Greenhow, Shereel Fall.
I didn't go inside the farmhouse because I was still remembering the fascist patrol that I'd been locked into. And so I decided to make my way back. But I had no idea where I was. I had no idea which direction to take. And so I just wandered around. Eventually it got dark. And at the first sign of any life, I just dived into the ground. And then, I don't know how long it'd been, but it must have been in the middle of the night. And I saw lights. And by that time, I was pretty desperate, so I didn't know. You know, I thought what I had to do was to find out who they are. And if necessary, give myself up or whatever. So I belly crawled all the way up until I could hear voices, and then when I heard a Scotch fair word, I knew that I was back where I should have been. I was back in the company. Absolutely amazing, really. I just wandered around all night looking for places, and then just wandered back and was back into the company.
What was this company called?
This was the first British company in the 14th, the French battalion of the 14th Brigade. This was the first British company. Later on, there was a lot of problems about its name, because when we got back to Madrigueras, or when the company got back to Madrigueras, it was reported in the British newspapers as the English company. And of course, the Irishmen took this and this and decided that they didn't want anything to do with this English company. And a lot of them left and joined the Americans, who were then coming in large numbers in the area to form the American Lincoln Battalion. But as I say, I crawled around, I found Pete Jansen, and he had an amazing story to tell me, because Pete Jansen had been used as an interpreter in the court martial of the battalion commander, who had then been shot for being a spy.
Who's that?
LaSalle. He was the commander of the French battalion. He was the battalion commander who had sent us forward and, with the idea of capturing Mopera and so on, who had said that there would be the artillery barrage for us to go forward and so on.
What did he tell you about the court-martial? What did he tell you about the court-martial?
Well, he told me that he had been accused of clandestinely meeting the fascists and telling them about us, that he had been in contact with them all the time, and that was why we had fallen into this trap of overlooking Mopera and then being bombed and shelled by the fascist troops, because as far as we were concerned, it was only a sort of guerrilla force that was in there. De La Salle was actually executed. There wasn't a great deal of fuss about this. On afterthought, you know, it could be that we much preferred to believe that there was treachery rather than incompetence. And therefore, you know, it bucked our spirits up to know that we hadn't made a mess of things. We had been traitorously led into something.
So you think he was a scapegoat?
I think he was a scapegoat. But, we had lost Cornford. I think I saw Cornford shot. Everybody else says that Cornford went to try and find Ralph Fox, who was with us as the political commissar of the company. Ralph Fox had just disappeared during the night, and there are stories that Cornford had gone to try and find Ralph Fox. Now, my own memory is something completely different. Because I remember that morning lying, waiting for this artillery barrage to start, And I am about 10 yards from the top of the ridge. And at the top of the ridge, there is Cunningham, John Cornford, Nathan, and this other man who'd come, I forget what his name was, who'd come from the Tailman Battalion. And when the machine guns opened fire on, I'm quite sure I saw John Cornford fall. Because we were raped by machine gun fire from the side, from this valley on the other side, you see. Now, it could be that, you know, don't forget that there was a degree of panic here. And I may not be right, but that was my definite impression, which I always carried with me, you know, that he had been killed. He was one of the first to be killed as the machine gun fire raped the top of that crest.
Can you give any detailed description of it?
Only insofar as, you know, as I say, I told you that we had advanced, you know, without any, during the night, and had taken up position on this this slope, and we could see, on the other side of the slope, we could see the smoke rising from the village, which was just on the other side, or the town of Lopera, which was just on the other side of the ridge. Then I saw these machine gunners, and everybody saw them, you know, there was sort of gesticulations, look, George, look, it's over there, it's machine gunners, you know, and so on. Other blokes would get their rifles and thought they were going to fire over there, and George would say, look, creep down, don't let them see, you know, no point in firing across there, it's too far, and so on, you see. And then the first artillery shells came over, dropped behind us. We didn't know that they'd come from them. We thought they'd our artillery. So we're sort of getting ready to spring and run forward. And then it was realised, you know, we realised because of the noise and the air bursting shrapnel that it was their artillery that was having a go at us. Then the machine guns from the opposite side of the valley opened up, and we were then being enfiladed. And that was when George told us, you know, to retreat. And there was quite a number of shell holes on the way back, you know, that were still smoking, and lots of air-bursting shells that were bursting all the way around us. And a few minutes later, the Irishman I was with, he was wounded with shrapnel, and he went down. And as I say, I tried to lift him up, but then, fortunately, a couple of stretcher bearers arrived. You know, and you know, when you're in this sort of battle, they seem to come from nowhere because you never expect anybody else to be behind you, that sort of thing, you see. But they did come and they carried him away, and then I still had his gun, and I also picked up a rifle that had fallen down, and I couldn't use this thing on my own because it was completely useless, you know. It was a useless weapon anyway. You know, because it jammed so quickly, you could probably single load a rifle quicker than this thing would fire. For the rest of that day, we were just fighting a retreating battle. And then, of course, there's all sorts of rumours. The night before we'd advanced, when after our initial attack on the ridge, and when we took these trenches and so on, and then we advanced and then we settled down for the night, a man from Manchester, actually George Brown's brother, Mike, he came out to Spain with us, and he fell into the sort of saucer thing that I was lying in, and he was really fed up, you know, sort of, the bloody army is this, and we're all fucking mad, you know. What do you mean? I said, we won the crest. George B. Round, and he said, there's plenty of new Newcastle says, George, you know, and he's really tearing away like mad. And he said, anyway, he says, I'm not staying in a madhouse like this, I'm off. And I didn't realise, when he says, I'm off, I thought he was just going back a bit, you know. But the next thing we knew was his photograph in the Daily Mail and the story of the incompetence and the idiocy and so on, you know. But he'd managed to get back to England. The general sort of information was that there was a Canadian ambulance unit which was helping deserters to get back to England. This was just a rumour. We never had any proof of this, you know, but there was this rumour that there was this sort of bogus ambulance unit which was helping people to get back who were prepared to tell their stories of brutality and desertions and so on, you know.
Do you think there's any truth in it?
I don't know. I mean, I never saw Mike again, and I never broached the subject with George. And the other brother is my brother-in-law. My sister married a Brown, and he's alive now. He's the one, he didn't go out to Spain. And I've never approached him about it either, you know, because I thought it's a sour subject. There were five brothers, and they were very, very close. And so, you know, all right, so Mick may have had, a legitimate excuse because we were mad, you know. I mean, it was a stupid thing that we did. And it was only because we were so unused to war that we actually did this sort of thing. So, you know, in one way he was right, and in the other way, on the other hand, he had volunteered like we all had, and so it was a different matter.
What do you remember happening next?
Well, the next thing was when we were moved, we were taken away from this front. Somehow or other, our activity had stabilised the front a little bit, and so then we went to the defence of Madrid, the Battle of Las Rosas, and this was, you know, that the fascists had completely surrounded, or nearly surrounded, Madrid, and they had been brought to a halt in the university area, and then they were having another go from the northwest, and so we were went back to Andújar, got into a train. While we were waiting in the railway station, this aeroplane came round again and strafed the railway station. And we even saw officers firing pistols at this aeroplane, which must have been a couple of miles high, you know. But this was the sort of army it was. We eventually got into the trains and shunted around all night, and then waited all day in a siding, and then when we got out, we got into trucks and travelled all night. Quite a nightmare, this journey, because we must have been close to the front area, because if the driver put his headlights on, there was an enormous wake cry of Pagalamuth, you know, put the lights out and so on. It was quite eerie a drive, and we must have arrived just before dawn, and the place we were in was very much like Kinder Scout. It was an area of white stone walls and gullies and thick icy mist, and we got out, had some coffee and bread, and then in this famous arrowhead formation, we started to walk forward. And there's mist all the way around, and there's all sorts of figures. There's tanks wheeling, there's gunfire, there's bullets zipping around. And we've no idea what we were, where we were, you know. The rumour was that we were the second line, and therefore, if the first line was bogged down, we would have to take their place and continue, because we were sort of advancing very, very slowly. And
was this before or after Christmas?
This was after Christmas. This was January. Because on Christmas Day, we went into action in Mopera. And we were on this front for about 5 days, you see, 3 days of actual fighting, and then a couple of days when we were just in reserve to see if there was a counterattack. Having stabilised the front, we're still waiting, sort of sunbathing, doing nothing. This was the time of the court-martial. Maurice Levine, you may have heard of Maurice Levine, he was the, him and Sid Quinn, they were the escorts who marched De La Salle backwards and forwards to the courtroom for, you know, from his cell. And as I say, Pete Jansen used to come to me every night and tell me what had happened during the day, you see, at the court-martial. The evidence that had been presented, and De La Salle absolutely in tears, claiming, you know, this is ridiculous, I never did this, and so on. All of these stories I got from Pete, you see. And then when we moved into the Las Rosas front, we spent sort of 2 days in this area. And it was freezing cold. We still had this sort of summer uniform on. Somebody came up with some ponchos and so on. Then we'd get food from time to time. And then one day we moved into what was a sort of shallow gully. And it was very much like the Pennine District, you know, with this wide outcroppings of rock. And so we're all lining the top of this small gully in pairs. And somebody came with some sacks of meat, tin meat. And they were throwing one tin of meat up between two. And at that moment, a machine gunner opened up from the side. And artillery, or tank artillery, I'm not quite sure which, but it was light artillery, pinpointed this, the top of this ridge, and the first one caught two people and killed them outright. And then George shouted out, "Every alternate man dropped back into the gully," and they all dropped back, you know, one by one. Again, an artillery shell caught and killed one. Then the next thing, I get a terrific bang on the back of my neck, sounded just like an iron bar hitting me. And from the machine gun on the side, I've got a bullet through the neck. And I rolled down, Pete Jansen followed me and bandaged me up, and it didn't seem too bad. You know, I'd had this terrific bang, and they just bandaged my neck. And then Nathan came over and told me to make my way, and a little farther on there would be a road, and the ambulances were flying up and down this road. Now I don't remember reaching that road. The next thing I remember, I wake up in Madrid, and I've been picked up, been to Dr. Tudor Hart's field hospital. And then I'd been sent off to Madrid, and I think we were in a hotel which was being used as a hospital, a Grand Hotel or something like that. It was being used, and in the next bed to me was Pete Marlon, the man from London, the bald-headed, ginger-haired, ginger-bearded interpreter who had been Nathan's interpreter, and he got a bullet through the leg. It appeared that the bullet had just grazed the spine and it caused a shock, so that I was sort of unconscious for a couple of days. But apart from that, you know, it was just a flesh wound. But it had been near enough to cause a nervous shock, so that I was unconscious. When I did wake up, I was lying in bed, and there's a whacking great syringe in here.
In your thigh.
The nurse came and pushed it a little bit further, you know, a sort of anti-tetanus injection. And We were in hospital for about a week, and I was able to get up after 3 or 4 days. And I wandered around Madrid having a look at it, actually looking for a cigar for Tony Varner, see if I could find him a cigar.
What was Madrid like under siege?
Actually, right, the centre, by that time, there hadn't been a lot of bombing. And so the street sellers were everywhere, you know, selling Sam Brown belts and holsters and badges and still selling the lottery tickets and the cigarettes on the trays and so on. So it was, even the theatres were still operating, you know. I remember that La Boda de Sangre by Lorca was playing in one of the theatres. And the cafes were open and so on. So it didn't seem like a city under siege to me. It looked like any other, you know, any other big city. But on occasions there would be a siren and then everybody would run and then they would all come out again, you know. There were barricades in the I think it was called Gran Vía. The cobblestones had all been set up as barricades, and there was militiamen manning the barricades. And beyond that, there was another barricade, and I was told I mustn't go beyond that one, you know, to have a look to see what was beyond that one, because you're getting close to where the action was. But, you know, I mean, you can just imagine 2 miles, not far from the bullring, everything was just like a normal city. Very strange. And then Tony and I were evacuated by train, and we went to Castellón, which is on the coast. And we were the only Englishmen there.
To a hospital?
No, it was a convent. And we were sort of walking wounded. And Tony and I used to sort of go out into the town. Tony was a great lad for conning, so he would talk to the bar owners, and we'd get a beer free until such time as we got some pay, you know. Because up to then we hadn't had any pay. And then while we're out on one of these walks, we saw a truck with the International Brigade insignia on. And when we flagged down the driver, we found out that in the next village farther on was an English convalescent home. And so we went back to the convent, picked up our few things, got in his truck, and he took us to this convalescent home, which was Benicassim.
What was the International Brigade insignia?
It's like three leaves. Just like this, and it was just painted on the side of the truck, you see.
Like a Mercedes symbol.
Very, very, very similar, yes. And when we got to this convalescent home, Benicassim was a sort of holiday home place where the rich people had their holiday homes. It was a semicircular bay, beautiful semicircular bay. You could go swimming every day. It was warm enough to go swimming, you know, still January, February, getting towards the end of January. And the doctor in charge was a man I knew from Manchester. It was Dr. Sollenberger, who was from the Bury Royal Infirmary. And he was the doctor in charge of the convalescent, and I must have been there a week, 10 days, something like that, and I'm sort of getting better again, because the effects of the anti-tetanus was wearing away, and the effects of the shock was wearing away. And then one evening Dr. Sollenberger called us all together and said, He'd had news that the British battalion, which had been formed, had been in action, that they had suffered a lot of casualties, and that he felt that it would do much more good to go to the front and reinforce the decimated battalion to stop it from taking Madrid, stop the fascists from taking Madrid, than being a doctor. And that night, two trucks would leave Benicassim and go up to the front, which was in Harama. And anybody who wanted could come on. Actually, Doc had to take about three of them off the truck and say, you know, you're absolutely, you will be in more of a nuisance once you get there. But everybody else went. And we actually went to Albacete, where we saw the, what was the name of this big Scotsman? Communist Party from Scotland.
Kerrigan.
Peter Kerrigan. Peter Kerrigan was the commander of, you know, in charge of the base at Albacete. And he had, in the meantime, I had been reported killed. Because they lost me. Because after I'd been in Tudor Hearts Hospital, I was sent to the wrong place and then was lost. And so, as far as the British were concerned, I was dead. You know, because there was no further trace of me. And so I was able to put it right about that. And so we were given. We were given some money, some clean clothes, and told that the next day we would be going up to join the battalion. Now I think this must have been around the 12th of February, because when we arrived up there, they were preparing for a counterattack. The worst of the battle was over. Was over, because this took place, I think, on the 8th or the 10th. Might have been a bit later than the 10th. The front had settled down a bit. The crisis when the battalion broke and ran was over. We were, you know, I was told about this, what had happened. Because as we marched up to join the battalion, on the right-hand side was the HQ. On the left-hand side was an old wine-making place in a cave. And this was the battalion cookhouse. And the cook in charge of there was the man from Manchester, who'd left his two children with my family to be looked after, whose name's Randy Garrett. And my sisters were looking after his two children. And he should never have gone out there. I mean, he was already, you know, he was already late 30s, 40, and as a matter of fact, after Harama, when the battalion left Marana, he was sent back to England again. But he was cookhouse and he was telling me all the news and everything else. And I was 3 days in the line with the lads waiting for this counterattack. The actual counterattack was done by the Americans. We tried to support them, but we were just pinned down. There was no way. According